Wouldn't it be great if there was a statistic that just sort of measured whether someone was worthy of going into the Hall of Fame?
Either joking about, like, I expected it to be, you know, leafed in gold, or, you know, why is the DBWA still using Windows 95?
You know, count up all the people that Jonah Kerry has taken to lunch in the last 3 years and and persuaded them to vote for Reigns. Like,
and welcome to Artificial Turf Wars, episode number 41, where all of our ballots are pre-printed with Tim Raines checked off. I'm your host, Greg Wisniewski, and I am joined by Josh Howsam. Hello, Josh.
Hello.
On this, our Hall of Fame Spectacular.
Woo!
Yeah, there you go. Listen to the crowd back there, man.
Yeah, go guys! Hall of Fame! Woo!
Oh yeah, I really like this one.
I hope we all get to go to the Hall of Fame! I don't even know what we're doing. But before we get to the Hall of Fame, because it's a big episode, we have three different guests. We have Jay Jaffe, we have Sam Mellinger, and we have Ben Lindbergh, one of whom talks about the Hall of Fame every year, one of whom has voted for the very first time as a Hall of Fame BBWAA member, and one of whom looked into the sudden resurgence of Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens on the ballot. Yeah, we also have questions from you. But first, a little bit of Jay's news before we go Hall of Fame crazy. By the way, this is probably going to be like a two-part episode, we've decided, because it's big and we don't want you to have to download a massive file. So, you know, if you enjoy part one, look for part two.
Okay.
Jay's news. We start with Edwin Encarnacion.
Yeah,
former Blue Jay.
The not quite Jay's news.
In former Blue Jays news, you said people should probably not be too happy if Edwin signs, as you reminded me, for a three-year deal that's pretty cheap. And then he signed for a three-year deal that's pretty cheap.
And people shouldn't be happy. I mean, look, there are a bunch of reasons why this happened. There was a whole piece that Shai Davidi wrote about the timeline and how things got screwed up. But what it didn't mention, and what seems to be glossed over, is when it came down to even just right when he signed, if he was going to sign for 3 years, $60 million, the Jays should have absolutely been in on that.
Yeah.
I don't care if they already have Steve Pierce and Kendrys Morales. Do not do it. Pierce.
You did it for me.
But I don't care. Like, put Pierce in the outfield. For that money, Edwin Encarnacion should still be a Blue Jay.
Well, honestly, you're right. You're absolutely right. Because for that kind of money, you can sort out Justin Smoke and Kendrys Morales and whatever before spring training is over. Like, it's not like you couldn't work something out where you got some value for one of those guys, even if you move them off the team, or you just bite the bullet on Smoke. I mean, you obviously can't do it on Morales because you just signed him to a three-year deal. But, yeah, there I don't know. I think, like, someone in the front office figured that the ship had sailed, and that was the end of that at some point.
So I just want to get it. How can you figure that the ship has sailed? He hasn't signed. And if you just ask Paul Kinzer, he'll go on the radio and tell you, this is the kind of offers we're getting.
I don't know. I still feel like Paul Kinzer might have been part of the problem there.
Yeah, but I mean, it sounds like the Jays just stopped trying once they got Pierce. I mean, they're saying, yeah, it'd be really hard now. Why? Why would it be really hard?
Yeah, you've had dumber situations over which to find playing time when you carried Smoke, Encarnacion, and Colabello for 4 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll figure that out. Bad. What you gonna do? Nothing, because it's over now. Jose Bautista is not over. Jose Bautista, the latest rumor, I'm not sure. Do you want me to touch on the Phillies rumor first?
Not a real rumor. That was just people saying that he makes sense because they're waiting. There wasn't actually a rumor.
It was a good Photoshop, though. It's like a cardboard cutout of Bautista in front of a picture of some street in Philadelphia.
It wasn't even a cardboard cutout. It was just a picture of him that was Photoshopped in uniform.
spotted in Philadelphia. I said that should have been his booster juice cutout. Like, if you really wanted to sell that, you put him in the booster really juice uniform. Okay, so the real...
Anyway,
tell us the real rumor.
Well, it's just that he's apparently now willing to take a one-year deal. It's, I mean, apparently it has to be over the qualifying offer or something like that, which I don't see the Jays doing. But if he's willing to sign for 1 year, he should be a Blue Jay.
Again, why the heck not? He's a legend around here, and he's a good player.
In 1 year?
There are no bad one-year contracts. Haven't we said that before somewhere?
I believe I've heard that. Yeah, it's just, it's Jose Bautista. The guy fills the need. We need outfielders. And he's Jose Bautista.
Yeah.
And there's no long-term crippling. It's just, you know, 1 year deal, and then you go find someone else next year.
Yep. And you're not really, I mean, okay, you're giving up the draft pick. But isn't everybody giving up the draft pick at this point? The only time you don't get the draft pick is if Jose signs after June 1st, right?
Yeah, and then John Morosi's making noise about that. Oh, no, sorry, Steve Phillips. It's not happening. Jose Bautista's going to be on a team on opening day.
You heard it here first, folks. Well, actually, you probably heard it somewhere else, but you heard it here.
Yeah, I think it's safe bet.
Yeah, I have a feeling Jose Bautista is not in Ian Desmond territory, is he? Is he one of the people who had to wait until the season started to sign?
No, it was just Kendrys Morales, oddly enough, and Stephen Drew.
It's the circle of life, of draft life. All right, and lastly but not leastly, we have the long-term news about Aaron Sanchez, because it really doesn't affect anything the Blue Jays do this year, but Aaron Sanchez has employed Boras Corp.
The Jays finally have a Boras client.
Yeah. That was kind of a backdoor way to get one, too. Well, they did last year. You don't
they
remember?
Did?
The excellent Franklin Morales is a Boras client.
Oh, yeah, right. I forgot about that. We even talked about that, how it was the first one since, like, Brad Wilkerson.
Worked out so well.
Oh, hopefully this one works out a little better.
Six innings? Four?
Yeah. It was a special train wreck of a comeback. But yeah, I mean, like you said, this is not a short-term issue. It's a long-term one, just because Boras tends to take his guys to free agency. So, you know, Aaron Sanchez is around for four more years, most likely. And he'll be 28 when he's a free agent. So there's no reason to assign an extension before that, because he will get paid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, entered the league early, performed well. Yeah, the only reason a guy would do that is because he thinks he's going to blow up for some reason before free agency.
Like Steven Strasburg did.
Hey, what do you know? And did he not? Who signed the extension with Boras? Someone, was it Strasburg they brought up?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who'd already blown up once.
And then he got hurt again.
So, hey, if you want to bet on Aaron Sanchez being injury prone, then I guess you can get that extension you hope for. But,
yeah, when you start hearing extension talks with Boras, you know Aaron Sanchez is hurting.
It's like, damned if you do, damned if you don't, I guess. Is that all we really had happen on the Blue Jays front?
Yeah, it's been horrible. Nothing's happening.
Yeah, nothing positive, nothing that we can hang our hat on, really. All those holes we talked about last podcast are still there. Wow, that's awesome. It's fantastic. So we're going to leave the Blue Jays behind now for a little bit, because there are no Blue Jays on the Hall of Fame ballot this year. But that doesn't mean it's not an interesting ballot.
Technically, Brett McGriff's on there, but I know what you mean.
Yeah. Is McGriff on the list of... I haven't looked at him on the tracker. Is he officially eliminated from this year's selection? Let me check. Yes, he is. He cannot be elected this year.
Too bad.
That is from, which we will get into later, the Hall of Fame Tracker website, which we're going to give you, because if you're into this, it is the coolest place to keep up on everything happening with the Hall of Fame. But first, we are going to talk to the man who tries to capture everything going on in the Hall of Fame every year with his JAWS system. It is Jay Jaffe of SI.com, and we are going to come back with him right after this little break. And we would like to welcome back to the program Jay Jaffe of SI.com. Jay, how you doing?
Hey, not bad. Just trying to survive the flood of Hall of Fame season as usual. I'm dealing not only with the analysis of all the candidates this year, all 34 of them, but also working on changes for my book, The Cooperstown Casebook, which is coming out in June, and adapting to fatherhood as well. So we've got a four-month baby girl here at home to juggle with my wife going back to work. So it's all a little chaotic here, but a lot of fun.
We will try and stay focused, and I'm sure you're a Hall of Fame father. All right. So I guess for those who are not familiar, we should start with your articles every year are based on something you came up with called the JAWS standard. Just give a quick overview of what that standard is and how you came up with it.
Sure. What JAWS is, it's the Jaffe Wins Above Replacement System. Jaffe Wins Above Replacement Score. It is a system that I developed starting back in the 2004 election cycle, using advanced statistics, namely wins above replacement, to compare each candidate on the ballot to the players at his position who are already in the Hall of Fame. To do that, I use career wins above replacement, a peak total, which I define as a player's best 7 years, and I average those two for the JAWS, which is just a score. I call that average the standard. Basically, the idea is we're looking for players on the ballot who would at least maintain the standards of the Hall of Fame, if not elevate them, rather than lower them. We're not looking for, you know, the worst candidates here. We're looking for the best candidates here. We want the ones who improve the Hall of Fame. And right now we're in a historic time here where we've got, as many or more who could fit on a ballot available for election here. So we've had a flood of candidates in recent years. JAWS is the basis of my system, but there are things that wins above replacement doesn't capture postseason stuff. Doesn't capture historical importance. It only goes so far in accounting for the high-scoring offenses that we saw and whether PEDs are involved and how you feel about that obviously has a big impact on how you view some of these candidates. It's a good first-cut system. And then, we rely on history and your own logic in order to get it down to a manageable number of candidates to vote for.
Just a fun note, actually, on your JAWS system. On Primetime Sports, which is a radio show here in Toronto, have you been on it before? I'm actually not sure.
I have been on many Toronto radio shows. I honestly don't remember
Bob McCowan.
Exactly what I have and haven't done. It's somebody gives me a number, somebody says, I'll call me at 4 o'clock, I'm saying I'm there. So, with Sportsnet in particular.
Okay, well, yeah, it is the Sportsnet primetime radio show, but okay. Just a few weeks ago, they were actually discussing the concept of the hall, and one of the hosts said, well, wouldn't it be great if there was a statistic that just sort of measured whether someone was worthy of going into the Hall of Fame? And then there was a call-in segment, and someone called in and said, yes, it already exists. Jay Jaffe, JAWS.
Nice. That's funny. Yeah, I don't pretend that JAWS is, should be the final answer. It's not a binary yes, no. There are always things that you want to take into account, but it's a tool, and it's like any tool. It's only as good as the hands of the user that it's in.
Yeah, and actually, on that note, in terms of the hands of the user, how much are you finding that people are using your JAWS system in their actual balloting? Obviously, you don't get a vote for another 4 years, so it's in Baseball Reference. Have you been finding that people come to you and ask?
There are some very big name writers who mention my stuff and who use my stuff, and I'm very proud of that. I can see, just based on the voting patterns that the candidates that I have been advocating for the last several years are the ones who have really seen their totals rise over the last few years. I don't know if it's directly because of me. Anybody looking at wins above replacement, I think, is going to draw some of those conclusions. But I'm gratified that candidates that I've endorsed, such as Tim Raines and Edgar Martinez and Mike Messina, have pulled out of the mire of down ballot obscurity to make themselves or to become strong candidates here, stronger as time goes by, and hopefully trending towards election here eventually, if not this year. So yeah, there are real voters using this stuff. I don't have an exact count, but I know that just based on the number of people who reference it in columns is more than 10% of the electorate at least.
That's pretty cool. So if JAWS itself were to have a ballot, I know you might not have this in front of you, but do you know that the 10 players who would be on that ballot this year?
Yes, I do. Do you want me to read them off?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Actually, let me get this page up here. I have it all on one convenient baseball reference page. Obviously, Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Jeff Bagwell, Tim Raines, Mike Messina, Curt Schilling, Edgar Martinez, Larry Walker, and Manny Ramirez are the 10. That should be 10. Yvonne Rodriguez. Yeah, we missed him somewhere there. So
he came right behind Manny on your list. So
yeah. So those are the 10. Now, if I had a ballot here, I don't think I would vote for Manny at this juncture. Because of the two positive tests, I think that voters how individual voter feels about PEDs is there's as many different opinions as there are sands on the beach here, but I'm of the opinion that you should draw a line between what came before testing, when there were no rules being enforced, and what came after testing, and to me to vote for Manny Ramirez when there are guys who can't get into the Hall of Fame for PED allegations that we don't have positive tests for, the whisper campaigns, the stuff that happened when the game wasn't self-regulating. I just don't think it's fair that Manny should be taking one of those spots, even though he is, one of the best hitters I've ever seen. So, he's somebody who I have reservations about voting for now. It'd be very interesting to see how he fares in the first year of his candidacy.
It's just sort of on the topic of the steroids guys and just characters, the players that have all these other things beyond their stats. What is your view on the way the numbers have sort of been shifting for guys that aren't on that list, like Larry Walker and Edgar Martinez? Is it a surprise to you that it took this long for these guys to start seeing an uptick in their numbers?
A little, but we've had such a flood of candidates, of qualified candidates over the last few years. I mean, we've seen 9 people voted in the last 3 years. That is a flood we have not seen in about 60 years. And the ballots are as crowded as ever. I have a count here where, this year we said there are 10 guys who meet the JAWS standard of their position. Well, in 2013, there were also 10. 2014, there were 14 of them. 2015, there were 12. 2016, there were 11. So there had never been, in the modern era of voting, which goes back to 1966, when the writers returned to voting annually instead of every 2 or 3 years, we had never seen that many candidates who scored that well in JAWS. And we've had an average now, I guess it's an average of just over 11 over the last 5 years. So, that's a lot of resistance, a lot of competition for somebody like Larry Walker or Edgar Martinez to overcome. And now that they are, plausibly one of the 10 best candidates on the ballot instead of one of the 15 best candidates on the ballot or whatever, it's easier for them to get that love.
So I guess, philosophically, if we're trying to get a hall that represents the very best of baseball players, and we're in this spot where there's this glut that's been created by just a combination of, like you said, a historical amount of players who are very, very good, and a ballot that has these limitations on it, and an electorate that historically doesn't like electing a lot of people. You combine all these things. What is success? Is success for the hall ultimately a change in the rules, or is it just enshrining maybe 3 or 4 people every year instead of like one guy per year?
Yeah, I think it's getting two or three guys in every year. I'd love to see 4. But it's really it's in a sustained march of let's just say an average of about three guys a year over an extended period of time to clear this backlog because it has become so backlogged. You look at the historical representation. Really, the last 40 years are fairly underrepresented in the Hall of Fame. You know, there are 15 to 20 guys missing from the post 1993 era, based on historical standards, just based on what the writers have voted in. Forget the Veterans Committee, relative to like on a per team per year basis, relative to previous eras. You know, there should be about another 15 guys in the Hall of Fame at a minimum. Relative to those eras. So, you know, we should be seeing these marches of guys. We're not going to get a rules change. I was on a committee with the BBWA a couple years ago. We tried to get them to upgrade it to 12 spots on the ballot. They tabled that motion. They're not budging on 75%. They've truncated the number of years of eligibility from 15 years to 10. You know, so there's we're not going to see rules changes that I think that are going to have an impact on this. It's up to the writers to get it right more than ever. And I'm grateful that, you know, my system has helped to recognize some of these guys and start the line moving again back from, you know, in 2013 when nobody got in.
And I imagine the new rule about revealing ballots should help at least get a better understanding of where certain voting sects are coming from. What are your thoughts on that process? Where they now everyone starting in the next year's ballot, not this one, will have to make their ballots public.
I think transparency has been great for this process. I think you look at the ballot tracking effort by Ryan Thibodeau and we've learned a whole lot about voters and voting patterns and as we've seen more and more voters, you know, willingly publish their ballots either before or after election. I think we've learned a lot. And I think, you know, last year, 70% of the ballots were published, you know, by, you know, either before or after the election. I think that was very informative. We're going to get it up to 100% eventually here, like with that rule change. I bet we could see 80% this year, or at least 75%. You know, I think accountability is good. Transparency is good. You know, there is some belief that there is a bit of you know, some pressure to vote for these guys, and the fact that social media is maybe not the most elegant place to debate differences of opinions, unfortunately, I think has some side effects in this. And there are people who just don't like this, don't like being, you know, they feel like they're forced to conform, you know, because they have to put their name on the ballots and because they have to withstand the barrage of why didn't you vote for this guy stuff. Know that maybe there's some kind of streamlining of the vote, but I don't know. I don't weep for the day when people would waste stray votes on David Eckstein or whatever, and you know, or anonymously, you know, things like that, and then some good candidates like Kenny Lofton would fall off the ballot with receiving less than 5%. I mean, that's still happening. We're going to lose like Jorge Posada off the ballot. He's going to be 5%ed. You know, Billy Wagner might be in danger of it, if not this year, the next year, if Trevor Hoffman doesn't get in, because there's only so much space for relievers on these ballots. You know, so I think that the transparency thing has been good. I think we're seeing much more focus on the top 15 guys on the ballot than we were before, and it's less scattershot, and I think that's good because we're seeing upward pressure. Get these guys in, get them off the ballot. Let's move on to the next guy and start recognizing these guys from a very imperfect era.
So ultimately, there has been the topic brought up about that pressure on the writers and the idea that just as you don't necessarily ask a player what the best strategy in a given situation is, maybe the writers aren't the best guys to be asking, that scholars who actually follow the game would be better picked to voting on something that is so representative of the game as a whole. Do you buy that argument as a place to go?
Well, I do to a certain extent. I think that there should be. I would like to see there be a faction of, let's just say, learned scholars get to participate in the vote. But here's the thing. I mean, this is the Hall's ball game. They empowered the writers, the veteran writers, 10 years in the BBWA. to handle this for them back in 1936. They've never deviated from that. Even if you were to come up with a panel of, let's just say, saber scholars, let's call them, you know, you're not, it's not going to be 500 people or 400 people to equal the weight of the right of the writers, and they're not going to get to do it immediately. These are people, you know, they've put in 10 years at a minimum, 10 consecutive years at a minimum, at affiliated outlets. Many of them, it's taken even longer to get that vote. You know, so to just grant the franchise to somebody else overnight or to, is not something that I think is going to go over well. I think as a long-term project, yes, I think it would be nice to see, you know, some saber scholars, maybe some broadcasters, other elements in this, you know, maybe you've got, but you're not expanding the franchise by that much when you're doing it. And I think we could theorize, till 2117, if there's a better way to do it. The Hall of Fame is not going to change its way of doing things by and large. It's a very conservative institution. You know, you're better off trying to start another Hall of Fame and get it right the second time than to expect the Hall of Fame, which is very happy with the way things are going, more or less, to suddenly change. And I say that as somebody who spent almost 15 years, you know, hoping for change and trying to implement change. There's only so much that can be done. It's, you know, it's you're dealing with some very powerful immovable objects here.
Well, taking it from like you mentioned, a powerful immovable not changing to the theoretical, you're writing this book, which you referenced earlier, the Cooperstown case book coming out in June. You know, the idea is players who should be in and who should be out. Now, were there specific players that really drove you to look into and write a book like that, or was it more based on your system, your Jaws system?
It's based on, you know, a decade and a half of studying this stuff and, you know, wondering what the hell is Chick Hafey doing in the Hall of Fame or all these other short career guys from the 1930s who, you know, hit 320 for 5 years and were friends with Frankie Frisch and got in, and why is that? Why did it take Ron Santos so long to get in, and what happened to Ted Simmons? It's all these questions that I accumulated over the course of several years, trying to figure out an answer, and to get a better systematic understanding of the institution and the voting processes. I was doing this from the 2004 cycle through the 2012 cycle at Baseball Prospectus, which, you know, as you guys know, is it's got some limitations with regards to paywall and reach. And then when I moved over to baseball to Sports Illustrated, and I started, I switched from BP's metrics to Baseball Reference's version of WAR, and got Sean Forman to put Jaws on every player page. Suddenly, you know, there was a lot more interest in it, a lot more visibility for it. Being on MLB Network didn't hurt either. You know, and then somebody asked me if I wanted to do a book, and I'd had an idea for a book for years, but, you know, that had been sitting on the back burner because I didn't have the audience, a big enough audience to merit doing a book then, and I didn't have nearly the number of answers that I have now, having gotten to be in the BBWAA, to understand how this process works, to spend more time researching and asking people questions about how it works, so this is the culmination of that, and it's some coverage of the top candidates who are outside the Hall of Fame, some looks at these various quirks in the system, like the Veterans Committee and the representation issues that I've talked about here, and then just a quick breeze through everybody who's in the Hall of Fame for their playing careers. I didn't go into managers or executives or Negro League players, which I wish I had the room to do it. As it is, I'm cutting 25% of the copy that I wrote for the book frantically.
That's for the second book now.
Yeah, that would be book two, maybe. Just to cover what's in the Hall of Fame here is difficult enough, but I'm very excited about this book. I'm hoping that one of these high profile writers who sung my praises will do the foreword of it, and maybe the plan is basically that this will be out in June. I'll be able to take it up to induction day ceremonies and hopefully celebrate Tim Raines' election, Jeff Bagwell's election, whoever else is getting in as well, and to hawk some books up there. And, you know, that it'll be successful and I'll get to do another one.
And hey, folks, if that appeals to you, Jay's book is already available for pre-order on Amazon.com. How was that?
Yes,
that
it good? Is. Yes, it is. And we're going to figure out some fun promotions for people who do pre-order it, some fun giveaways and things like that.
Well, thank you very much, Jay. They can find you on Twitter at
JAY_JAFFE, Jay Jaffe, two words.
Of course, at SI.com.
And at SI.com.
Many miles of column every year.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Thank you for joining us, sir. And all the best getting the book edited down.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Good luck with the fatherhood.
Thank you. Thanks. Good talking to you guys. Happy New Year.
You too. Thanks.
Happy New Year.
And we are back. That was a whole lot to take in, I think, but pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, the JAWS system is really neat. You know, it attempts to distill a player's overall contribution with their peak, which is something that nothing else has ever done.
And it reflects on, you know, trying to figure out what they were doing in the past to seemingly come to those conclusions, with obviously taking out the I was a drinking buddy of this guy on the committee people. fun fact, of all the names in the Hall of Fame, only about half have been inducted by the writers. Did you know that?
Yeah, the Veterans Committee went nuts. So you get all these players from like the 20s and 30s that are garbage that are in the Hall of Fame.
But also, the writers have never inducted anyone from the Negro Leagues, right? So, and they don't vote on any executives.
That's
so it sort of makes sense that they can't really induct everybody. But the writers seem to be really, really obsessed with, for the like the 60s and 70s, not letting anybody into the Hall of Fame, which just... it's a total head scratcher for me.
Well, actually, the 1990s and the 2000s are the least represented era of the Hall of Fame. 80s, 90s, and 2000s, ever.
Yeah, I don't get the 80s thing either. I just, this mindset got in that you should only put like three guys on your ballot, even if there were really good players. I don't know. Very strange. So in
that
light,
it's a good segue to our first question from Razorblade.
Our first question from Razorblade, as you said, does address the, I didn't do that intentionally, the three-person ballot.
Yeah, it's, I probably could have sent you just Steve Marcus. Hopefully I'm not just picking on small hall guys. Who has the worst ballot? Now, he sent two ballots. One from Steve Marcus, which listed Vladimir Guerrero and Trevor Hoffman. And the other one, which was three, from Mark Kreidler, which was Vladimir Guerrero, Trevor Hoffman, and Tim Raines.
No, Jeff Bagwell on the Raines and Hoffman ballot, not Vlad. Unless he sent a third ballot. He did. He sent three ballots.
Oh.
There's more pictures.
That's right. Yes, Bob Padecki. I couldn't read that one. Jeff Bagwell, Trevor Hoffman, and Tim Raines.
Yeah. They're all equally bad. I'm sorry. I can't express how annoying it is to see a ballot like that. I literally don't know what to say. Do you try not to get
too crazed over the quote unquote bad ballots, which these are, because it's just like, you know, they come every year. And in part two, we had a talk with Ben Lindbergh and he expresses the same kind of sentiment, but these are bad. I mean, especially, okay, so the Steve Marcus one, which he says he didn't want to, he said he could have just sent us that one. Just Vladimir Guerrero and Trevor Hoffman. I don't understand how you even get to that.
No, I don't either. Is it the dartboard method with an incredibly small dartboard or unfamiliarity with the game of darts or like, what is it that would make you say, okay, there are 34 names on the ballot. I mean, it can't be name recognition, because you certainly recognize a lot of the names. You want to cross off all the guys who potentially had,
Steroid before, whispers.
Yeah, steroid or whatever whispers. Okay, that eliminates a whole bunch of guys. But if you voted
Jerk, can't have him.
Yeah, okay, I guess. But if you took Trevor Hoffman, you put him on the ballot, the only reasoning I could see is that when he retired, he was the all-time saves leader and he was a dominant closer. That would be my candidacy for Trevor Hoffman, right?
Which means Lee Smith should be on there.
Exactly. That's exactly what Lee Smith was when he retired. Okay, so you... Fine. Okay, Vlad Guerrero. Like, is the justification I only enjoy bad ball hitters with incredible throwing arms, and he's the only guy who fits the bill? Those are the only people who should populate the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it's just really surprising. And like I said, like, look, people have the right to vote however they want to vote. You know, I mean, that they've earned it. They've been covering the game for a long time. And now that all the people who don't cover the game are out, there's some expectation these people are still doing it. It's just baffling. It's like, okay, Trevor Hoffman, but where's Mike Mussina? I mean, what can you have against him or Edgar Martinez? If you're Hoffman's a specialist as a reliever, how can you not have a specialist as a DH?
Yeah. And I mean, you cannot be looking at super elite performances here because neither Hoffman or Vlad was the super elite player. So in that regard, we'll move to our other question, which is not on my screen right now because I'm a genius. It is from Rocker Big D at I Want McMuffins. Sometimes I just love reading the Twitter names. So he says, blow it up, start from scratch. How would you structure Hall of Fame admission?
I'll let you field this one first.
I think first of all, there's a lot of things to do differently. One of which is you don't necessarily have writers are never really in the Hall of Fame, despite what they say. You don't have players and executives and builders and owners or whatever, all in the same Hall per se. I think you do players only. Second of all, I think you get a lot more clear about what rules should be in play for someone to be in or out of the Hall of Fame. If it's straight statistics, great, it's straight statistics. If it's more focused on, if you want to be focused on what they did, you know, in the playoffs, then specifically state that. The rules are way too vague. And I think you do let things change from year to year with some direction year to year. And I certainly don't think you put a limit on the number of people someone can select on the ballot. Once you found the criteria, you let people vote for as many people as they want to. Should the writers be part of the voting contingent? Absolutely. Should they be all of the voting contingent? No. That's some things I would do. What about you?
Well, I think you covered most of it there. But I think the biggest thing is, I think that clarity from the Hall of Fame on steroids guys would clear up so much. It's like, if I mean, as you've said, the fact that they're on the ballot should be clarity enough. But if the Hall comes out and says, we don't care, or we absolutely care, the issue's done.
Mm-hmm.
But they won't do that.
Well, it's almost like at the moment, there's not even anybody to ask. Like, the ballot comes out of this mysterious photocopier from 1993. And at this point, it could be typed out on a dot matrix printer. I have no idea how they get these things out there. And I know the Hall of Fame has a president, et cetera, et cetera. But this process seems unnecessarily shrouded in mystery.
And somehow Javier Vasquez wasn't on it.
Right. And that's what I alluded to, I believe, with Jay. If not, I'll allude to it later, like magic. that the Hall includes people and omits people at the fringes. People we know are not going to get 75% of the ballot, but they meet the played mostly full time for 10 years. It's right in Ryan Tibbs' Twitter API. Thibodeau, sorry, it's at not Mr. Tibbs. It gets stuck in my head. Ryan Thibodeau's, who does the Hall of Fame tracker, which we highly, highly recommend. Again,
and we will link to on the podcast post, both parts one and two, because it's amazing.
Yep, and it will tell you every possible mathematical permutation of any player, what you're curious about, and goes back into previous years. It's awesome. But as he's got on his Twitter AVI, it says, if you play 10 years, you'll probably get on the ballot. What? That seems a bit vague when you're considering, you know, the highest honor you can be bestowed in this
sport. Best part is the little fine print, though.
I haven't
it
even
says seen... Yes, I know Javier Vasquez isn't on the ballot. That's why I said usually.
That's hardly the first omission, you know. And the idea of guys dropping off because they don't meet the 5% requirement because of some weirdness is also something that, you know, again, I don't think it would happen if people were allowed to vote for as many people as wanted to.
If they were allowed to vote as many people as they wanted, it wouldn't be necessary.
Yeah. People would just stick around until they got zero votes. That would be my feeling, right? As soon as you get zero, then you're off the ballot. You stick around until nobody thinks you should be there.
So like Darren Erstad would last for an extra vote.
Yeah. But again, since there's no 10 limit maximum or 10 person, 10 vote maximum per person, it doesn't matter how big the ballot is in any given year, except that maybe they'd have to pay for a second sheet of paper, which again, yeah. I don't know what the budget is because it doesn't seem very high. But you have to actually mail in your ballot.
Hey, one of our part two interviews, Sam Mellinger, loves it.
I guess, man. Some people love the Model T Ford. It's got its nostalgic qualities to it. Anything else we want to touch on before we send this one off and head out to part two?
No, I think that's good.
All right.
People can tune in for part two tomorrow.